You're listening to Irish Radio Canada at Home and Abroad, and I'm delighted to be reconnecting with Catherine Dunn. And Catherine is an author and recently published a wonderful book, which I had the opportunity to read, A Good Enough Mother. And Catherine visited Ottawa a number of years ago with some other Irish writers to support an Ottawa lady who was about to publish her and had published her first book. Catherine has been writing and was first published in 1997 in the beginning, and she has written fiction, but one of her books was non-fiction, and it was An Unconsidered People, and that was published in 2003, and it was about the Irish experience in the UK, in England, and the challenges confronted by emigration and racism, in effect. Whether it was called that or not, but that was what it is. And those challenges are not confined to any one country. They may appear in different formats around the world, and certainly they also can be very apparent at times in Canada. But Catherine's most recent book, A Good Enough Mother, is taking on another topic. It's taking on a topic of mother and baby homes, of societal silence, of societal collusion to hide what was in a way not a problem, but was created as a problem. And that was that you had young girls who found themselves abandoned after they became pregnant, and the consequences of it. Catherine, great to be in touch with you again. Great to have you back. And A Good Enough Mother, a most wonderful, disturbing read. Because if it doesn't disturb, there's something wrong.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Austin. It's lovely to be back and, as you say, to reconnect all over again. And just to say about An Unconsidered People, during COVID, that got another lease of life. It was republished with a wonderful introduction by our professor of history here at UCD, Dermot Ferriter, whom I'm sure you've come across on many occasions. He did a terrific job. The title of that, Unconsidered, it's not that these people were forgotten, because their families certainly didn't forget them, but they were unconsidered by the state. And in a way, when you mention silences and collusion, I suppose that's really been one of my main themes as a writer over the last 30 years. Those stories which are unconsidered or silenced or haven't been heard or haven't been explored enough in some way. And I think while I'd started writing the book, it took me 4 years, and it's been published now in Italy since 2022, and then this year in Ireland. So, you know, you can do the mathematics as to when I started and when I finished. But as I was writing it, the Tuam baby home scandal, the mother and baby home in Tuam, the work that the local historian Catherine Corliss did, in literally unearthing all of those tiny bodies. I mean, the whole country here was just convulsed by that. And indeed, it was a story that went absolutely ballistic internationally and didn't show us in a particularly good light, nor should we have been. And it was just something I couldn't get out of my head. I had known about the Magdalen laundries, again, at one remove, learning about them when, if you like, everything had been closed down and moved on. But the mother and baby homes, the extent of it, something like 56,000 women over the years had been imprisoned within these walls. We weren't the only country doing it, but apparently we were the country with the highest proportion of women incarcerated of any country in Europe. And listening to Catherine Corliss speak, of course, fired my writer's imagination. And as with every story, you know, the question, what if, came to mind. And it was, what if I had been one of those women, or I had known one of those women, or indeed had been the child of one of those women. And fuel to the fire was the commission in 2021, which was a real whitewash of the whole situation. Women who were desperately waiting to get some sort of justice and acknowledgement for what they had gone through, found that their experience either had been recorded inaccurately or had been dismissed as not important, or great gaps left in their testimony. And that really infuriated me. I just thought it was such a desperate injustice upon injustice. And it met with the other, one of the laws then, that piece of legislation that came with the report, was that there was a cut-off point. So you had to have spent a certain amount of time, say I think it's more than 6 months, within one of those institutions before you would be able to apply for any kind of redress. That eliminated 23,000 women from the whole redress system. But worse than that, what I felt was it showed an extraordinary lack of understanding. It wasn't the months that were spent in the institution only that were the difficulty. It was the impact on women's lives afterward, mm-hmm. and their children. Mm-hmm. People whose babies were taken from them with no paperwork whatsoever, and being unable to find them, not knowing where they had gone. False photographs often being sent in some cases. Yes, this is your child and they're doing fine. People coerced into signing forms that they didn't understand. So all of my stories, all of my novels start really and finish with people. I mean, it's the characters that I'm interested in. The society and what causes them, their problems, that's the backdrop. And when I see them in that particular situation, I have to explore the backdrop to understand the difficulties that they have. But my job, I feel, as a writer is to make a fictional life as authentic as possible so that the reader gets a sense of what it would have been like to be that girl, to be that child, to be that grandmother. And yes, there were some families that resisted the social attitude towards unmarried mothers. You'll note that they're only unmarried mothers. There were never any unmarried fathers referred to. It was as though the young girls had got pregnant on their own. There were some families who resisted, absolutely, but that took an enormous amount of courage. And if you were in a small town where people were regularly read from the altar to their community because of some misdeed or another, you know, it's very difficult, or very easy rather, that we could look back through a 21st century lens and say, what on earth were they doing? But this was 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, when life was very, very different. And also, I think, to take into account, one of the things which really fascinated me, because I hadn't really thought about it in this way, was the use of shame as a method of social control. And again, that was collusion between church and state. For some sort of, I don't know, extraordinary perception of what respectability was, anybody who didn't conform to the moral standards had to be shut away. And these were mostly women, let's be honest, the women who were shut away. Men got away with a great deal more. So it was to try and bring life to that situation, to try and understand what it would have been like, and then to look at the difference that kindness and understanding can make, and how every family doesn't have to be your nuclear family. Families can have all sorts of different definitions. Mm-hmm. So it was a terrific project. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the writing of it very much.
Catherine, there was another writer, Claire Wills, and she wrote a book on a similar story, but it was factual.
Yes.
And what I found in reading that was that what you are describing was an evolution from the formation of the state, mm-hmm. and that prior to the formation of the state, much of the shame that you mention didn't exist. That certainly in the West Cork, where she wrote about, that it was accepted that, or it wasn't shameful, that if some girl got pregnant, well, maybe the family took the child in and they were reared as part of a family, a nuclear family. And there were mixed marriages and they were mm-hmm. socially, but that with the formation of the state and when we use the word collusion, I would say the exercise of control by the church over mm-hmm. even the state.
Yes. Was it short?
There was a creation of an environment. Mm-hmm. And that environment then was imposed by shame.
Absolutely. And I mentioned to you earlier a book by a journalist called Derek Scally, who wrote an expose called The Best Catholics in the World, an ironic title, obviously looking back at his own childhood, being brought up on the north side of Dublin, and exploring the attitudes where it was quite clear that parents knew that something unacceptable and inappropriate might be happening with a particular priest, but that silence covered all of this because this was something that you could not speak out against. And I mean, that is one of the things in Ireland since the creation of the state, was the creation of these walls of silence around all sorts of issues which were deemed not to be acceptable because it was part of getting total control over the population. And Derek talks in his book about the Bishops' Conference back in 1845, which would have been just after the famine. And the whole population was completely fractured and traumatized by what had happened. And this was seen by the church as a really wonderful opportunity to get control of the population. And it's from that date, he would argue, and I would agree with him, that our Irish Catholicism began to develop into the particularly joyless and punitive one that it became, which was not shared by Catholics in other countries such as Italy or Spain. It's only when the church locked forces with the power of a repressive state where that control and that silence and that power became absolute. And it was absolute. I mean, I remember being at primary school here in the early 1960s, and Catholicism filtered through every single aspect of the day. I remember even never knowing that I was told, I knew who the Protestant families were in the park where I lived. And my parents weren't at all bigoted. This was just knowledge that you grew up with, that there was a them and an us. And this whole notion of controlling, when a new state is created, I found this a very interesting insight as well. When a new state is created, the value of that state, and we're going back, obviously, back in history, back to the early part of the 1900s, whenever, but the value of the state was actually deemed to reside in the virtue of its women. So if your women were virtuous, whatever that meant in your own system of belief, if your women were virtuous, then the state had value. And that was something that the church and the state bought into wholesale. And that is why the existence of young women who are pregnant outside of marriage was completely and utterly unacceptable to that view of female virtue. And so the only thing you could do was lock them away. So we had the Magdalene laundries and we had the mother and baby homes. And the last of the mother and baby homes only closed in the 1990s. Things were changing, obviously, from the 80s on slowly. And then in the 1990s, well, this whole society went through an enormous trauma of actually finally beginning to understand and believe the extent of the abuse of children that went on in this institution, which had complete control of the population. Once that control disappeared, all the walls of silence have begun to come down in the last sort of 25, 30 years, and all sorts of things that were formerly unable to be spoken about are now spoken about. And this is where stories are become so important, because one of the reasons why the equal marriage referendum, for example, was passed with the enthusiasm with which it was, parents told the stories of how their children were suffering from homophobia, from being not an equal citizen under the law. And the stories of that human suffering are what changed people's minds and changed their perceptions, because nothing is ever made better by silence.
Catherine, you mentioned that you built your story around the human aspect, the person.
Yeah.
So again, if I refer back to Clare Wills, and I think now of Clare Keegan's.
Yes, small things like these.
Small things like these. And then Roddy's, the woman that walked into doors and the woman behind the glass. They're all about people. And mm-hmm. In all being about people, they're also relating to situations. So and what's coming across in all of those stories, it's a cycle. And within the cycle, it's the breaking of the cycle.
Yes.
And in yours also, the cycle being broken. And mm-hmm. it and what's fascinating is that how the cycle has been broken. And it's been broken by people who were part of the dysfunctional cycle previously. Yes. So to give a summary of your cycle, do you want to fill us in on how it's Tess, isn't it, finds herself, Tess is pregnant?
No, it's Maeve. There are
Maeve.
There are
yeah.
some changes of names throughout, which we're obviously not going to give any spoilers.
No.
But I suppose we'd stick with Tess for the moment, because Tess was actually the first character who came to me, because Tess herself was inspired by yet another traumatic event which was going on here during the years when I was writing, and that was the Belfast rape trial, which was, I think, yet another story which achieved international prominence. And there were some young men, very, very well-known rugby players, accused of rape. The trial itself was the trauma, not just for the young woman concerned, because it certainly was traumatic for her, but because for the rest of the population, it was traumatic in that it indicated and explored and illuminated social attitudes towards sexual assault and women. And basically, it was sometimes you weren't believed. Sometimes, what were you wearing? Did you have too much to drink? All of these questions. And I mean, at the moment, there's that appalling trial of the husband of Gisèle Pelicot going on in France. And again, her point is that what that is doing is, in the story of one appalling situation of one woman, it is indicating social attitudes in France which need to change. So Tess comes home one day from work and finds a Garda car sitting outside her door, and this is the opening of the novel. And she knows, deep inside her, she knows that one of her sons has done something that he shouldn't. So my entry into the book was actually, you're talking about cycles, this was yet another part of that dysfunctional cycle. And I had to try and find out, what would it be like, what would it be like to be the mother of a son who was accused of something as heinous as sexual assault? And then from that, her mother, Betty, grew, the character of Betty, the grandmother. So through all of the cast of women, and there are some men there as well, there's Angus as her other son, there's Luke, who's the boy who has been accused. And through all of those characters, what I'm doing is I'm looking to see what it is like to live through those cycles and to try and cope with them and to try and survive them. Because there's also, in the middle of all of these difficulties that I give my characters, obviously there's resilience, there's joy, there's friendship, there's all of the positive things that make up the different shapes of families that exist throughout the book. But it's to try and understand the level of the emotion that the character has responding to the predicament that society has placed her in. And to do that, really, it becomes a matter of kind of crawling into somebody else's skin. It's not enough just to project a voice. It's actually mm-hmm. to get into their skin and walk around in it mm-hmm. and see what it feels like and look at the world through their eyes. So what it meant was going back also to the 1950s and 60s. And this was where I used a lot of the research that I had done for An Unconsidered People, because one of the women that I interviewed there was a nurse in a London hospital. She was Irish, and she used to go to Euston Station every morning and wait for the train coming in. And she would know by looking at the young women getting off the train what stage of pregnancy they were at. So she was a really interesting woman to speak to. And through her and through other interviewees, I learned what it was like for those women to have been literally not just abandoned and shut away somewhere a few miles from home, but basically they had to leave the country because the sense of their shame was so great. And they had to shift for themselves in London, which was very big, very different, felt very foreign in so many ways. And how they survived was, again, a matter of their own resilience and their own strength of character. So the book traces, really, there are lots of scenes of Eileen, the character who goes to London. Her story starts in the 1960s. So I've been around for a few years, you know, so at 70, I'm able to look back on what was actually happening because I lived through so many of those decades and learned so much about them, both from talking to people and from writing about them. So it's a particular picture of the country, which is genuine in the sense that it takes account of the silences that surrounded these stories up until relatively recently. Now they're all beginning to come out, which is terrific. Things like gender-based violence, for example, which is an epidemic, not only in this country, but I think worldwide, it's beginning to be spoken about. The experiences of the women in mother and baby homes has begun to be spoken about. Experiences with people with mental illness, which again, other citizens of this country, other parts of the population shut away because somehow, again, not to be perfect, was something which, you know, society didn't want to see or consider.
And again, this is what you identify in this and what you just talked about. It is a universal issue because in Canada, of course, the whole residential schools and the removal of First Nations children and taken away to assimilate them.
Yes.
The justification for so many different things.
And in Australia.
And I mentioned earlier on about how it's about breaking the cycle. Mm-hmm. And that is the case with Claire Wills, with Claire Keegan, Roddy, yourself, and another book that's coming up shortly is Nesting with Roisin O'Donnell. It's about breaking the cycle and that the cycle of society, the changes in society have facilitated the breaking of those cycles. However, you mentioned something earlier on, and again, Claire Wills mentioned this, and you mentioned it, that the number of men. Mm. These things, they were not, it was, we're told there was one Immaculate Conception. but yet in Ireland, there appeared to have been 57,000.
Well, it's a lot of miraculous ones anyway, for sure. Yeah. No, there was no social censure. None whatsoever.
And still none.
I think that whole, I mean, all of the shame that used to envelop that, you know, single parenthood, as we would call it now, I mean, that has disappeared. That has gone. That certainly is one cycle that has been broken for sure. But no, the attitude towards the young men who were the fathers of all of these babies was that, first of all, they should do their best to get away with it.
Yeah.
And that if their family had any kind of standing, or even if they didn't in the community, they protected their son. Because again, the social opprobrium that would result from something like that was something that they weren't prepared to countenance. So the boys were protected. It was as though the women had become pregnant all by themselves, miraculously, that they needed no human intervention. And I mean, it's again one of the unfairnesses, if you like, of this, that the women are literally left holding the baby. And also, I mean, so many of these young women were so young. I mean, I have one of the characters in my book at 14, and I have to say that anything that I put, the mother and baby home St. Bridget's in my book is entirely fictional. However, everything that happens there has happened in some mother and baby home somewhere in this country, because I was very careful not to introduce anything that was a flight of fancy or imagination. Anything that happens there happened. For example, in some of the newspaper archives, I read about a young woman who was in the midst of breastfeeding her baby, and the baby was taken from her as she was feeding the baby. So all of these things that are there happened. 14-year-olds being pregnant, absolutely, I won't say common, but certainly more than you might think.
Yeah.
Young women who were the victims of incest shut away because they had become pregnant. So they really, you know, they bore the sins of their families and their entire societies. And there were some stories from women who were literally if they had escaped by going to London under their own steam when they knew they were pregnant, of them being followed and put on planes and taken back and put into a mother and baby home. So there are, you know, there are still so many stories out there of people who, women who are now obviously elderly, and many of them still haven't told their stories because the stories are too painful. And as I said at the outset, you know, over 20,000 of them not being entitled to any form of redress. So there must be a great deal of bitterness, which is justified, but it's very sad to feel that level of bitterness coming towards the end of your life. And particularly, you know, from the country which was supposed to, and the church which was supposed to nourish you and look after you and mind you. So there are still an awful lot more stories out there needing to be told.
Coming to the conclusion of your book, Luke is confronted on what would be a given the task of, I suppose, growing up.
Yeah.
And insofar as is possible, to do the right thing. And I think that was, again, breaking a cycle in that rather than ending with the chaos that people have their lives left in, that you're trying to bring a conclusion here that says there is a way to try to deal maturely with some of these things. It's
there
not perfect. It's not perfect.
No.
It's not going to change what has happened.
Yeah.
But there is a mature way to move forward.
Well, it gives a way forward, yes. And I think with Luke, I'm very interested in the whole concept of restorative justice, because I feel the trials which happen, first of all, there are so many women who will not report an assault to the guards. Because they understand exactly what they're going to be put through if the case comes to court. And so many of them don't because there isn't enough evidence. So restorative justice, which was, I gave my character the option of a different way to try and come to terms with what had happened. And from what I've seen about restorative justice, I really believe in the power of being confronted with the real live human being that you have harmed, and that you have to sit across the table from them and you have to once again listen to their story. And that story is something which makes an impact in a way which the adversarial nature of court will never do. And you know, even in terms of the, I wrote a book some years ago called The Things We Know Now, which dealt with cyberbullying at a time when it was just beginning to become a really big thing. And a lot of the research I read actually came from Canada, who were, the schools in Canada were trying to mitigate the effect of cyberbullying on students, because young people who were driven to harm themselves as a result of cyberbullying, they were teaching them that, you know, there is no way back. You know, if you commit suicide, that's it. It's over. You don't see everybody being sorry for what they did because you're not here anymore. And boys, teenage boys in particular, don't have any kind of concept of death, apparently. So this was something that they needed to learn. But in among all of that research, I learned that the reason why cyberbullying becomes so prevalent and so vicious and so all-consuming is because you never see the impact on your victim. If you're the bully at the other end of a phone, you send it out there on social media or WhatsApp or Snapchat or TikTok or whatever, you don't see it. And it's the anonymity of that that enables the bullies to really go for broke when they're bullying. And in the same way, because the court system is adversarial, the victim appears only as a witness. That's all. And often things like counselling notes, for example, intimate counselling notes, are made available to the prosecution. Just awful to me, which are like making you an anonymous cog in this particular adversarial wheel. And so I didn't want to put any character through that. And I thought justice, the other form of justice, is perhaps a way for people to understand that what they have done has been very damaging. And, you know, I know it's in its infancy, but I think it's something that could be very well used in situations like that.
Catherine, I'd be suggesting anyone to go try and get a copy of the book, give it as a Christmas gift. And if they were to do that, where might they find it?
Well, it's certainly available on Amazon. I know that's not ideal for giving of gifts, although I'm sure there is a way. You can get it from the publisher called Betimes Books. I don't think it's being stocked in Canadian bookshops at the moment, so I think the only easily accessible version will be on Amazon.
And if anyone wants to find out more about you and your books, you can go to CatherineDunnAuthor.com, and that's Catherine with a C, so CatherineDunnE author.com. Catherine, yeah.
And there's lists of independent bookshops on my website as well that will tell you if you happen to be in Ireland where you can get it from.
Brilliant. Catherine, it's been great for you connecting with you, and it's fantastic.
Absolutely.
And congratulations on wonderful book.
Thank you very much, Austin. Great to talk to you again.